Well, good evening, everyone. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm so glad you joined me tonight. Thank you. You know you can find us on social media everywhere. And if you want to ask a question of my guest any night that I'm on the air, go to my Facebook page at For Pam Stack, drop me a note in PM, and I'll be glad to go ahead and relay it. Otherwise, take down this number because you can call 347-633-9609. Tonight, I'm delighted to have with me Matthew Fitzsimmons, who wrote his first novel called The Short Drop. For those of you who have been living under a rock, let me just tell you that this book has skyrocketed to the top of Amazon book sales and in bookstores everywhere. As a matter of fact, he has over 4,300 reviews and almost all of them positive. I'm trying to look now. Yep, everything from 4 and 5 stars, mostly 5. It is a beautiful thing. This book by Matthew Fitzsimmons is on my short list for Book of the Year, and you know I'm keeping a list. There are only 5 authors so far, so it's going to be a tough year. Without further ado, I want to introduce to you Matthew Fitzsimmons, the author of The Short Drop. Good evening, Matt. How are you tonight?
I'm terrific, Pam. Thanks so much for having me on.
It's my pleasure.
Good to be here.
Thank you. And I'm glad you're having a relatively nice day where you live in the northern part of the country in southwest Florida. It was once again started off at 58 and rose to 83 today. So it's just your typical Florida day. Just thought I'd share that with you. No, don't be, because then we have the summer, you know, and that trumps everything
else.
Right. It's a horrendous then. I was reading your bio, and one of the things you said is that you wondered if you would ever write anything half as good as the first sentence of James Crumley's The Last Good Kiss. So I thought, wow, I wonder what the first sentence of The Last Good Kiss was. So I thought I would look it up. I don't know if you know it by heart, but I happen to have it here. So this is it. Quote, when I finally caught up with Abraham Trehernahe, was drinking at a bar with an alcoholic bulldog named Fireball Roberts in a ramshackle joint just outside of Sonoma, California, drinking the heart right out of a fine spring afternoon. That's the first line from The Last Good Kiss by James Crumley. Why are you taken with that?
Well, it's just so vivid. And I just think the turn of phrase, drinking the heart right out of a fine spring day, is just, well, it's beautiful. It's beautifully put. As a man of Irish descent, I can certainly appreciate the what that it's such a vivid portrait without overextending itself. And the idea of a bulldog named Fireball Roberts at a ball. I read that sentence and I stopped what I was doing. I'm like, and I knew I was going to read that book pretty much in one sitting, and I did. And what more could you want from a first sentence?
It was wonderful. So here's the description of The Short Drop. The disappearance of Suzanne Lombard has haunted Gibson Vaughn since he was a troubled teenager. 10 years later, he's been given the chance to solve the mystery of what happened to his childhood friend and daughter of the Vice President of the United States. So that's quite a hook. That is quite a hook. And especially from a young man such as yourself, who admits that this is his debut novel. I'm sure not your first writing experience, but it is your first published debut novel. Tell me all about The Short Drop and where this story came from and why you decided to write it.
Well, that is a multifaceted question. Let me parse that out.
Please do.
So the impetus to write it came about, so the book is dedicated to my Uncle Dave, who had been the editor of a national magazine for 25 years and had retired, and he decided he wanted to write a thriller, or was interested in writing a thriller, and he'd been going to conferences and so forth, and he One Christmas, he cornered me. It was Christmas Eve dinner at my parents' house about 4 years ago, and he said, "Have you heard of this thing called Thriller Fest?" And I said that I hadn't, and he said, "Well, it's a conference in New York every July, and you know they bring in authors and they do panels and discussions and so forth. And I'm thinking about going. Do you want to go with me?" And I gave it some thought, and he said, "You know, it'll be fun. We can go up together and go out to dinner in the evenings." And I hadn't really had a chance to spend a lot of time with my Uncle Dave for a variety of reasons over the previous few years. So I said, "Sure." I was teaching at the time, and I had summers off, so that sounded like a great way to spend a weekend or 4 or 5 days. And so we went. I had no intention of writing a thriller at the time. My own interest in writing it sort of waned at that point, but we went, and we went to, you know, they have sessions in the morning and sessions in the afternoon. Yes. And they give you a great big stack of books. And
yes,
somewhere in the midst of it, Uncle Dave bought me a copy of Dave Morrell's 100 Best Thrillers Ever Written.
No, David's he's the king. He's the king.
He is the king. He's unquestionably the king. And by the end of the weekend, I came away with what now in retrospect I realize to be an incredibly arrogant and hubristic thought, was that I thought to myself, I think I could write one of these. And I spent that summer working my way through David Morrell's book. And my stepfather is a tremendous reader of thrillers, so I would pop over to his house and just basically raid his library, sort of 4 or 5 books at a time, read them, and then deliver them and swap out for the next 4 or 5. And I think over that summer, I probably read 40 or 50 of the books off that list. And,
wow.
And I started writing Short Drop that fall, I think in September.
Professor Morrell, as I fondly call him every time he comes on the show, numerous times, and we always have a good laugh about it. I don't know if you know, he wrote a book about Frank Sinatra. That was our last conversation. He's an interesting fellow. But he is, as you know, the father of the international thriller writers and therefore Thriller Fest, and a very generous man. When you were going to your uncle's house and taking the books on David's list, what book stood out for you the most, or 2 books?
Oh, that's a good question. Scott Trow's Presumed Innocent.
Yes.
It was Killing Floor, the Jack Reacher book, the Lee Child's novel.
Right.
And they were interesting because I hadn't read a lot of thrillers, to be honest, at that time. It wasn't the genre that I read in predominantly. So there was a lot of education to do there. And those 2 books were really interesting to me because they were so opposite in their approach, and that, you know, that Jack Reacher is such a classic Western hero, and that he has,
yes,
no personal attachments. He rides into town, cleans up the town, beds a lovely lady, and then rides back out of town once, never to be seen from again. And Mr. Turow's book is who I was fortunate enough to meet at ITW's Palm Beach Peril in January. Just an incredibly gracious man.
Nice.
But Presumed Innocent was interesting because it was so opposite in that it was so couched in family. And if you've read the book, the family element is so critical to the story. And it was an interesting and sort of almost diametrically opposite pair of books, and that for me kind of informed how I went about writing the Short Drop to an extent, because one of the big questions my agent had when he read the book was, you know, Gibson Vaughn in the book has an ex-wife and a daughter, and
right,
they're very important to his backstory, but there was a pretty strong discussion about whether or not to keep them in the book, because it's a complicating factor, and there was a lot of back and forth about whether to. So go ahead.
No, I'm listening to you. I'm thinking the same thing. You'd have to keep up with their story along with telling the story in the present about what's happening. So you end up with a lot of characters, and you have to decide how much they bring to your story, I would imagine.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think that's why so many series often rely on sort of, if you go back to sort of the Raymond Chandler, that quite often the detectives don't have a lot of personal connections,
right?
Because from a purely pragmatic writing standpoint, they can become burdensome. to keep track of and to keep current while not derailing the current book or story.
Absolutely. So I want to circle around and ask you a few questions and then we're going to get back to the short drop. I love your story about living in the Orient. You tell me a little bit about that, because you have a very interesting little thing that happened to you that you said you sparked a near riot. So would you start from the beginning of that and explain to listeners how you almost sparked a near riot?
So the story there goes that it was the mid-90s, and I was living in Nanjing, which is Nan means south, so it's the southern capital, where Beijing is the northern capital. So Nanjing is about 4 hours by train from Shanghai. And I was living quite close to Nanjing University, where the Chinese had recently become crazy for soccer. They absolutely adored the game, and they played it on every available surface at the university. And they started an intramural league. So, the economics school had a soccer team, and the chemistry school had a soccer team, and so forth and so on. And they invited the foreigners who were associated with the university or studying at the university to field a team. And there were about eight or nine, they had about 10 guys, and they knew I had grown up in England, and they were desperate for players. I hadn't played soccer since I was 9 years old when I was in London, and they asked me to play. And I said, well, I haven't played in years. I'm 6.5 feet tall. I kind of switched to basketball when my growth spurt hit. And they said, no, that's fine. We'll handle it. We'll stick you in defense. We really just need a warm body back there. And I went, okay, well, I can do warm bodies, the best of them. So, we started in this league, and, what became apparent quickly was that our team was so much better than everyone else, than the Chinese players. I mean, we had a German player, a French player, two Italians, an English fellow, and they had been, they could really play. And then they had me in defense. And we were beating in this league these teams quite badly. And we were drawn, that sort of the game before us, there'd be maybe 10 people watching, and then our game would start, and there would be 300 or 400 fans would start to show up at this field. And as the season went on, and as we got to the playoffs, it started to get quite tense, because we were winning these games, early games, we were winning 15-0. And
right.
And I did not score a single goal. I this is in no way because of me. I just sort of stood in the back and fed the ball to our the European players and let them do all the hard work. Anyway, so it began to become a little bit of a a tense situation, and the Chinese teams began to feel disrespected, and we started to try and not score as many goals to try and keep the we'd been invited into this league, and we were showing
annihilating
up our gracious
it. You were annihilating
we were,
it.
we were annihilating our gracious hosts, and they weren't taking it all that well. So we got to the playoffs, and we were in this game, and there was a huge crowd, and the Chinese came down and they took a shot, and the ball went whistling past the goal, and the goalie ran to get the ball, and the players all started jogging back to get in position for the goal kick. And the Chinese striker ran by my defensive companion, the English fellow, who was this little bulldog of an Englishman from Manchester, just about as wide as he was tall, and loved to fight, bred and born to fight. And the Chinese player ran past him and kicked the English player in the calf, just as he was running by, just kicked him real, real hard in the calf and kept running. And the English player didn't take it well and shoved the Chinese player. And now everyone's looking. And no one saw the Chinese player get kicked. The Chinese player kick the English. And all they see is the Englishman and the Chinese man now fighting. But I saw the kick, and I go running over, all 6'6" of me, and I essentially crash into this Chinese player to try and separate him from him. My chest hits him, and he's about 5'4" and 130 pounds.
Oh.
And I launch him like Sputnik into the atmosphere. And all 400 or 500 people watching this game, that's all they see. They now see two foreigners assaulting this Chinese player. All hell breaks loose. And I'm surrounded, I swear to God, by 15 Chinese men in track suits. It's like something out of a Bruce Lee movie. Like literally, like those, they're all wearing matching track suits. I feel like I'm in Game of Death and I see red. I stand my ground, and I'm ready to do battle for this righteous cause. And it's a one Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi. And our captain, the German player, comes out of nowhere and grabs me by the collar and whispers in my ear, "Run." We ran like hell out of there and we didn't stop until we got back to the foreigners' hotel where they lived. And fortunately, the riot abated. But I was forced by the university to write what's called a piping, which in China is a self criticism, which to the Chinese is enormously shameful. It's a huge loss of face, where you basically write a letter that says, "I'm a terrible human being, and I'm completely at fault, and I'm a loser," and that becomes this mark of shame on your permanent record. And they're like, "Well, you're going to have to write a piping." And I'm like, "Well, I'm American. I do shame. It's like I don't care." So they made me write this piping and say what a terrible person I was, and then they shook their finger at me and said, "Well, I hope you've learned your lesson." And I nodded and looked shameful and said, "Oh, I absolutely have." And they said, "Well, good. Well, then we'll
love that you called
there.
It your first work of political fiction.
Right, where I said, yeah. So
now,
what was your
association with the university? Were you a student, or were you teaching, or were you just living nearby?
I was both living nearby and teaching. I was actually writing a novel, and I was teaching theater at the university.
You have a very interesting history. You were born in England, but you are
You grew up in Chicago,
I'm sorry. But then you grew up in London, and then
right.
and I don't know what Kings Road punks are, but I'm assuming that's some kind of like a street gang of some sort. And you said your biggest traumatic experience was seeing Star Wars in December 27, 1977, in Leicester Square, listening to your father sleep through what you thought was the greatest cinematic achievement of all time, and fearing you were adopted. I love your sense of humor. So yes, it makes sense that you would be a writer. So then you went to New York, but then you, what caused you to go to China? Were you a teacher by then in New York?
No.
And you just
so
okay.
So
I'm a little confused
York.
About all the moving around. And were you hiding out from someone? Did WITSEC fail you? And, you know, really, because you were teaching English, literature, and theater at a private school in D.C. for a while, too. So I'm a little confused. Will the real Matthew Fitzsimmons please step forward?
Well, that, well you're going to have to get in line for that one. So I was born in outside of Chicago in a small town called Wheaton, Illinois, which is famous for Wheaton College, the Bible College. And when I was about 4 years old, my dad was transferred to London. He was with a Chicago bank, and we got moved over there. And it was a wonderful time. We spent about 8 years in the heart of London, right in Kensington.
Yes.
You couldn't ask for a more spectacular childhood. And it was the late 70s, and when I say the Kings Road punk, so Kings Road was where my school played soccer. We played soccer at the Marine Barracks on Kings Road. And the punks, that was like the heart of the 70s London punk scene, you know, Sex Pistols,
yes.
The Clash, those bands. And Malcolm McLaren's store, Sex, and Malcolm McLaren was the manager of the Sex Pistols. Malcolm McLaren's fashion store was on the Kings Road. And England was suffering from terrible unemployment at the time. So the pubs are opened early, and, you know, a lot of young people didn't have jobs, and sort of punk and punk fashion was an expression of the dissatisfaction over that. So, you know, along came traipsing these like young school children in uniforms on their way to soccer, you know, 6, 7 years old in their English school uniforms. And let's just say the already inebriated Kings Road punks were deeply amused by our appearance. So I grew up in London, and when we came back from England, we went to Washington, D.C., where my family has been based ever since. But after college, I went to New York to pursue a career in theater, and I was there for a couple of years. And it was a hard time. Theater is a unforgiving business, and it wasn't my best time. But I left New York a little bit with my tail between my legs, and decided I would take up writing, and started writing a novel. And I met a girl, and she had a job in China, and she said, you know, she got a job in China, said, hey, do you want to go to China with me? And in the sort of decisions you can only make when you're 24 years old and don't know a thing about a thing, I said, sure, that sounds like a great idea. So off we went to China together. And we had to pose as a married couple. So we stopped in Hong Kong and bought a fake wedding ring before we got into the country, because the Chinese wouldn't let us live together if we weren't married. So perhaps that might have been my first act of political fiction.
Yeah.
That is how, in fact, I came to China, and we were there for 2 years, and I wound up teaching theater because that was my background at the university while I worked on a novel. And, yeah, so that is how that time.
Did you enjoy being in China?
No, I didn't. I mean, it was the mid-90s, so China was just opening to the West. And, non-Chinese were a relative novelty in the 80s and 90s in China. So a 6'6" white person in China was a kind of a thing.
You weren't hiding anywhere. In other words, you weren't hiding yourself anywhere. Yeah, I bet. Interesting.
So they would people would follow me around, touch me. One night we're sitting at a restaurant eating dinner, and an older man brought his granddaughter over to the side of the table and just stood about 2 feet from us, and they stood there watching us eat, and they were speaking Chinese to each other. And I asked my pretend wife what they were saying, and she said, "Oh, he's telling his granddaughter to watch the funny foreigners eat." So there was a little bit of a sense of like being a zoo animal.
A little bit. You're talking about England, London, particularly in 77. I happen to have been there with my brother, and I recall that was when we would kind of chuckle because, we're from Miami, and it wasn't at that time a trend-setting city. And we remember seeing all the guys and gals with the colored hair and the straight-up punk haircuts, the mohawks, and mm-hmm. all the beads and the tats and the funny-looking clothes and all. And just giggling because we were kind of young. I mean, my brother was younger than I am. And I wanted to take pictures, but I didn't want anyone to hurt me because I was taking their pictures. So I never did it because I thought, I'm short. I'm only 5'4". And at the time, I was very small. And I was afraid someone would hurt me. And even though my brother was a lot bigger than me, he certainly would have said, "Well, you deserve the beatdown, kid," you know. So I never did take pictures, but I remember that time. It wasn't an unusual time, but always fascinating. So now wherever you were on one of the circulars, the I don't know what they call them. I can't remember what they call them. I guess
roundabout.
The roundabout, yeah, where all the kids hung out. It was really interesting being there. Now, China is not a place I have ever had an interest in going to, so I don't know about that. I have been to Thriller Fest in New York. I do know about that. Your first novel that you started writing when you were there, did that turn out to be Short Drop?
No, not in any way. I decided that I would write the great American novel. It was much more of a literary piece full of important ideas and piercing insights, none of which I think turned out to be true.
F. Scott, right? You were going to be the second coming in F. Scott, and at 24 years old, too, because you had learned so much in that long life of yours.
Exactly. I like to joke that my great American novel was neither great nor especially American, as it turned out. So no. The Short Drop is a completely. I spent about 3 or 4 years working on that novel in my 20s, and by the time I was done, I no longer really enjoyed writing. And when I realized that it wasn't salable, I pretty much hung up. I don't think I wrote for 8 or 9 years after I stopped writing that novel. I was burnt out and decided that wasn't going to be an avenue for me that was really going to be open. So I moved on.
It seems to me that you couldn't be the tortured art actor in New York. You certainly weren't going to be the tortured author with the great American novel. So you decided to teach instead and be a tortured human being, be a teacher.
And torture perfectly nice 18-year-olds, exactly.
There you go. You said that before you went to Thriller Fest that you were not reading in the thriller genre. What were you reading?
I read primarily what I would call literary fiction, a lot of European authors, Ian McEwan, Kazuo Ishiguro, Milan Kundera is a huge influence on me. And then I was a devotee of sort of what I call the new American male authors, you know, at least at the time, Don DeLillo, and now I'm forgetting his name.
But shows you terrific authors.
Yes.
Nothing wrong with that, but they were not the ones that you were highlighting chapters on. And when you finally did the short drop, you weren't tearing their books apart, obviously. Let's talk about when you were writing the short drop. First of all, it's my understanding that as a writer, and trust me, as a talk show host, you have a lot of ideas going through your head. You think, what am I going to talk about? For me, what am I going to talk about? Who do I want to talk to? What do I want to learn from this person? So I have a lot of things in my mind. Sometimes I get them answered and ask and answered, and sometimes I don't. So it occurs to me that as a writer, you probably are faced with the same thing. You may have an awful lot of ideas floating around. How do you decide which one you're going to choose to write about? Or did you have this novel already in your brain?
No, what's interesting is that the short drop actually initially was a very different book. I had a very high concept that I'd come away with from Thriller Fest that had occurred to me, and I'd jotted down on something. And Gibson Vaughn, the character who eventually became Gibson Vaughn, was quite different and had a different set of issues than he actually wound up having. And I eventually discarded entirely. I kept the character and discarded sort of my high concept altogether. And I started from the character. I actually, once I discarded it, the building of the story itself actually just started from the character, because I wanted to think about what I wanted Gibson Vaughn to experience and what I wanted him to go through. And I began, I perhaps in a very backwards way, started building the story from where does he start psychologically at the beginning and where would I like to see him finish up, rather than sort of picking the mystery and then putting the character through it. I tried to think out where I wanted the character to begin and end, and then built a mystery that would, or built an adventure or a story that would move him from point A to point Z, sort of psychologically, emotionally, and so forth.
I don't think that's backwards at all. I mean, you have to have a character that people are going to be invested in, and you certainly get invested in him immediately. I mean, he's so torn apart by what has happened to his childhood friend, and I it grabbed me from page one, I have to tell you. And I'm kind of a picky reader these days. I have a lot of books come across my desk. I have probably 1,000 a year come across. I end up reading about 400.
Wow.
Yeah, so I have to pick and choose very carefully, and if something doesn't grab me on the first page, I'm not interested. So, which means nothing as far as the short drop is concerned. It's just that I think you captured it immediately and wisely. When you talk about writing a high concept novel, you kind of set yourself up for a fall, don't you?
You can and you can't. I mean, I think you. It depends whether or not. I don't think that short drop is a high concept novel. So I speak from a position of relative ignorance, because I, as yet, have never attempted a high concept novel. But I think they can succeed or they can't succeed. I mean, you take something like a book that really impressed me, which was sort of a science fiction thriller, which was The Martian.
Yes.
Now that, you know, that's a book for me that's very high concept. I mean, I think that, I've never spoken to that author, but my guess is that it began from a, how would someone survive on Mars? I mean, it's classic high concept. Like, what if you're abandoned on Mars? How do you survive? How do you get rescued? What would you do? And what I admired about that book is that that he does such a nice job making Mark Watney a part that he doesn't. I think you can. I think you're absolutely right. I think you can, particularly in film, sort of lean so heavily on your high concept that you get lazy about other important pieces and disregard what actually makes a story a success. But I think you can do both. I think high concept can be a real boon if you are mindful of the other pieces.
When you went to Thriller Fest the first time and you came back motivated to write, did you sit in on the panels? I mean, were you there just to tell me what you got at, what you went into hoping for, but what gem you came back with? And have you gone again?
I have not been back. I went to I went to BoucherCon. So I went to Thriller Fest as a curious
sure.
outsider, and then I didn't go again. I went to BoucherCon just this past October in Raleigh as
what
a.
Was there?
Yet
Why
to be
didn't
public...
we talk to each other? We didn't even talk to each other. I don't understand that.
Well, I was a tall fellow at the bar. So
you and Jason,
it was
tall fellows at the bar. I was the short blonde laughing. So this year we're going to have to change that. Are you going to NOLA this year for BoucherCon?
Oh, absolutely. I signed
and
up.
And are you going to Thriller?
It was,
oh, good for you. Wasn't it fun?
It was wonderful. I really was. You go to those sorts of things, and you don't know what the community is going to be like. But one of the things that really I came away with was just how warm and positive and inclusive
and
this community of writers.
Yeah,
and encouraging.
Yeah.
I didn't even have a book out yet. I was just, I was at that point, an unpublished hopeful. And people were so warm. I had dinner the first night I was there with Reed Farrell Coleman.
Yes.
Unbelievable. He's a fun guy.
Yes, I know. He's been on the show. He's a fun man, too, isn't he? I need to
he's
take
fantastic.
A break right now. He really, and he's funny, too. I need to take a break to remind everyone this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. Folks, it is my pleasure to speak to Matthew Fitzsimmons, whose debut novel, The Short Drop, is winning reviews and raves everywhere. It will not surprise me. I'm sure you're on a short list for awards throughout the season. Matt, if you'd like to call in and say hi to Matthew Fitzsimmons and tell him what you thought about his book, as long as it's good, you're welcome to at 347-633-9609. And if you have not read The Short Drop, please give a call and tell me, and I'm going to gift you a copy of it. So here we have our first caller, and I suspect I know who this is. Hi, you're live on the air. Who's this?
Hi, Pam. This is Teresa. How are you?
I'm well. So, Teresa, let me introduce you to Matt Fitzsimmons. Matt, Teresa is the reviewer who went crazy for your book. She is part of our book review crew. Say hi to Teresa.
Well, hello,
Russ.
Teresa.
Hi, Matthew.
Hello.
Nice to talk to you.
Very nice to meet you.
Thank you. I'm like Pam. I have a lot of books that come across my my desk every year, and I actually found yours on First to Read. And
mm-hmm.
I was totally enthralled from the very first sentence all the way to the end. That does not happen very often.
Yeah.
And
that's wonderful to hear.
My husband, who is a pretty much strictly sci-fi reader, I kept telling him, you've got to read this book. You've got to read his book. And so he finally sat down and read it, and he's like, okay, I'm 50% through. This book is amazing. I'm 75% through. This book is amazing. It really, really is an amazing book. It was my book of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she posted that, as a matter of fact, on one of our Facebook pages. And
I recall.
When I told Teresa that you were going to be a guest, she says, I'm calling in to say hello. And I said, by all means, do. By all means, do. So I think you just reposted your review, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, so Teresa reposted, and it's going through our social media feeds right now, too.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
You're very
Teresa?
Welcome. I'm just looking forward to his next book.
Yeah. So stay on the line. Let's talk about that. You said you, before we went live, you told me that you had just finished up, sent your next manuscript to your editor for the first round of edits, and have recently just gotten it back. Do we have a working title that we can mention, Matt?
Absolutely. The title is Poison Feather, all one word. And is dauntingly already up on Amazon for pre-order. So,
tell us a little bit about that.
So it is the second Gibson Bond book. It picks up about 6 months after the events of the short drop, the following spring, and because of, without saying too much, if you've read the book, you know how it ends up, but things are looking up for Gibson at the beginning of the book. He is dreaming of sort of the quiet life that circumstances denied him, and unfortunately for him, fortunately for me, that doesn't last. Otherwise, we'd have no book. And he gets a request from someone from his past to look into a Wall Street financier who's serving a 8-year sentence for securities fraud, who's due to get out of prison in about 30 days, and has given a very ill-advised interview to a major magazine in which he suggests that he still has money hidden away, squirreled away, waiting for him when he gets out of prison. He doesn't say it directly, I've always admired enormously Elmore Leonard, and one of Elmore Leonard's cleverest tricks was that he often relied on the stupidity and foolishness of his characters to instigate action. If you think of Get Shorty, Get Shorty wouldn't have, the whole movie wouldn't happen except that the fellow who survives the plane crash at the beginning and gets the insurance money doesn't sneak off quietly. He goes to Vegas, lives large, and everyone knows exactly where he is. Like, if he had just done the smart thing, and Elmer Leonard was great at having his characters not do the smart thing, but not do it so stupidly that it felt not organic. Like, he didn't make his criminals brilliant. So,
it's classic noir. It's classic noir storytelling. So, this sounds fabulous. This it's Poison Feather, all one word, or Poison?
Poison Feather, all one word. So it is.
And
it's
why
a, it's
is
a,
that?
I can't tell
why
you
the
that.
Title?
I can't tell you.
Okay. All right. So that's part of the story. How interesting is that? When you are writing your books and titling them, is it a difficult thing for you to think of a title? I mean, I saw exactly in Short Drop where the name came from, but how did you decide to use that?
Short Drop actually had a different working title. when it I sort of had the holdover title that was the when I sort of still stuck on my high concept, and that title stayed in use for a long time, and I really it was when I was writing the scene where the title comes from, and I started researching it because I needed I didn't know very much about that. And I stumbled across the term, and I looked it up, and it made sense on both a literal level and all of a sudden the metaphoric explanation for what sort of Gibson Vaughn's life had been. And then I did what I think probably all authors do when they think they've hit on their title. I ran to Amazon, put the title in, and prayed to God that it didn't.
Nobody
pop
else
up.
Had used it.
That nobody else had used it, and it hadn't. And I was like, oh, thank God. I remember this. I was like, oh, please. Because I'd had two or three others that I really liked and that someone had used recently, like 2 years before. So it was like going to Vegas and playing craps. And, I blew on my fingers, and I typed in short drop, and it didn't pop up. And I was like, all right, and that's how we got it.
There you go.
Well, I think the title is perfect. If you read the book, it's perfect for the book. And
yes.
I would like to go back to something that you spoke about a little earlier as far as leaving Gibson's wife and daughter in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I think that really helped define his character in the book, and I'm really glad you left that in.
I thank you. I do. So it was a very long and it was a very smart conversation with the people who were concerned about it. And their concerns were, I understood their concerns, but I really didn't want to write another male lead character who had no emotional or familial connections. I just didn't want. I'd seen enough of those. And it does. I think men without the presence of other people in their lives are uncivilized. It's particularly for men in the absence of sort of civilizing ties are just less interesting to me.
Well, and me too, because he wasn't a really warm and fuzzy character. But when he goes back and talks about his daughter and even his ex-wife, then it makes him more of a person I'd like to read about.
That was my hope. I think 80% of the thriller reading audience are women. And I think particularly if you're going to be a male author in this genre, if you have to be mindful. I wanted to write a thriller that would appeal to both men and women. I didn't want a thriller that only appealed to one gender. And I think that's a big piece of it. I think you're absolutely right that he isn't a particularly effusive person. Life is sort of taken that away from him to an extent, and without the wife and the ex-wife and daughter, he becomes much less interesting and understandable as a man.
Matt, did you decide when you wrote this book, or did it come afterward, that you wanted to make him a serious character, or will he be a short series character, like a trilogy maybe, or will you use him, do you think, again, like you mentioned, Lee Child's Reacher?
I think that is to be decided, to be honest. When I wrote the book, I wrote it with the idea that it might be a series, but it also that it could be a standalone if I was lucky enough to find an agent and a publisher that could, and they just wanted the one that I could tie it off and then move on to something else. B, because it is as done as well as it has, I've been lucky enough. We're definitely going to do a second, and I believe the intention is to do a third and possibly even a fourth. I've been unbelievably blessed and fortunate in the way it's gone. It has obviously opened doors that as a debut author, I didn't even consider or dream of really at the time of publication. So I think Gibson,
Professor Moreau would tell you that it's part being in the right time at the right place, part having the talent to write a really good story. And it is also part luck. You never know. It's a roll on the dice. And from a reader's standpoint, you're well deserving of all the accolades. I want to ask you, when the book first came out and you knew people were looking at it and reading it, how often did you go look at reviews?
I definitely tracked it. I definitely checked every day to see where it was ranked and how it was overall being reviewed. I tried to resist reading the reviews as much as possible. I think that's what I do. I do have a friend who liked sending me the one-star reviews he'd make up fake email headings and then paste the one-star review into it.
I don't think you have any.
Oh, they're in there.
So let me just say this now so that you understand this. You've had your one-star cherry popped. And now you're over it, and you can just go on and deal with it. You know that the people who write one-star reviews like that are trolls, and you never have to worry about them again. I say this to everyone I speak to. Did you get a one-star review? They said, yes, I got my first one. Good. Your cherry's been popped. Move on. Okay?
I don't worry about it at all just because – you know, I actually, the week before the book came out, I made a point of going and looking at the pages of four or five books that I consider to be masterpieces. And after you read a couple of one-star reviews of Great Gatsby, you know that you're going to get them. Like, if Fitzgerald is going to get one stars, and Fitzsimmons ought to get a lot of one stars like that. So I don't have that doesn't bother me one little bit.
Listen, when your overall rating is high and as many as you have, that is a spectacular debut novel. I want to talk to you for a really long time because I'm so interested in your story, but I know that wouldn't be fair for me to keep you. I want to ask for the last callers before I have to let Matthew Fitzsimmons go. The number is 347-633-9609. If you've not read the book, call in, ask a question, and I'll gift you an e-book copy. Matt, generally toward the end of my show, I do something called Final Five. It's five quick questions and five quick answers. Are you game to play?
Absolutely.
It's all about you. I mean, I'm not going to give you trick questions but only if I think of them. So, you've done a lot of really interesting things in your life and been a lot of interesting places and obviously have read a lot of interesting books. So my first question is, when you are writing, do you need quiet? And if not, do you listen to music?
Yes, I do listen to music.
Tell me what kind of music you like and what do you listen to for writing?
I'm going to be one of those people that I have a absolutely mammoth music collection. I listen to music from almost every conceivable genre. And so I have a playlist of about 1,200 songs that I call my writing playlist. I like music that has lyrics and good lyrics.
Don't you get the two crossed up?
I really do. An artist that I like a great deal is Tom Waits.
Yes.
And when I was writing sort of the end of book two, which when everything goes completely to hell, I listened to a lot of Tom Waits, and it sort of suited it sort of set the mood for me. I try and think of there's a chapter early in book two of Gibson and his daughter. And that was a very specific musical feel for me. So I'll think about that before I pick out what I'm going to listen to. And I think it does. I think it does mix up for me. But I don't find that to be. That's not to my. I don't feel it's a detriment. I feel it's a value add for me.
Good for you. What book have you read more than once or twice?
A book that I come back to an awful lot is a book called Immortality by a Czechoslovakian author named Milan Kundera, who's probably best known for Milan Kundera's most famous novel.
Talking to me made you brain damage. That's what happened.
He wrote The Unbearable Lightness of Being. That's the one that he's famous for, which was made into a movie with Daniel Day-Lewis. Why do I keep reading it? Kundera is just this wonderful observer of humans. It begins with this breathtaking passage to me of an older woman swimming in a pool on a rooftop. And the author is watching her from the building across, and she begins flirting with the 22-year-old lifeguard, and he says that for a moment she forgets her age, and she turns to him and makes a gesture of a much younger woman, and the author sort of ruminates about the idea that gesture and gestures are immortal, where people are not, and that human beings just borrow gestures, and that the gestures themselves will live on forever. And I've read that. I've come back to that book time and time again because it's just, as I get older, it speaks to me in different ways. And then, obviously, as an English teacher, I've read there are certain books that I've read 50 or 60 times. Because you read it every year with the students a couple of times.
Do you like the books that you have to read to your students?
I did.
You have to read with them.
I taught at a private school in Washington that offered an awful lot of freedom. So I got to create the curriculum to a great extent. So yes, I picked them because I believed in them. It was a very nice position to be in.
What book did your students particularly glom onto?
Well, that's the no book gloms with all students. It's really interesting. You've got to really, over the course of a year, you need a variety of books. Hemingway's Sun Also Rises was often a big hit with a number of students. I used James Baldwin's Notes of a Native Son, and that was often a big hit with a different group of students. We did Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon, and that would hit with a very with our most literate students, and she's such an unbelievable titan. It's such a difficult book for a high school audience, but
it's a difficult book for most adults. So it's not only the students. You really have to want to read literature. You're talking really. Did you do any genre assignments?
Not especially. Some of our younger grades, they did, I didn't do it. I taught the seniors. They did Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game, which was always a favorite. I always wanted to do more science fiction, but never found an appropriate unit to sort of package that all together in. So no, not especially. Oh, I did do Truman Capote's In Cold Blood for quite a while. So that was probably my closest genre.
Wow. Interesting. Well, I got off track there. So my next question to you is, give me two things on your bucket list, not necessarily as a writer, but just as Matt Fitzsimmons.
Oh, wow. You that is a good question. I don't know that I have started a bucket list. I should probably get busy on that. You're making me question my mortality here on Monday night.
You're the one who brought up immortality. What can I tell you? We'll skip that and we'll go to something else. Let me think. Okay, I got one for you. Every writer has their virtual toolbox or a literal toolbox where they sit down to write and they have things that they pull out of their toolbox. So, you know, maybe it's a laptop, maybe it's a candle, it might be your music. What are some interesting things that you use in your writer's toolbox to get you going and to keep you going?
So I would say one of my morning rituals, so my day is generally 7 a.m. to about 4 in the afternoon. I have two workspaces. I have a desk in my office, and then I live in an apartment building. We happen to have a beautiful rooftop that's covered with that has a trellis, and they've grown vines over the roof of it, so it's shaded all day long. So I sit up there, you know, from mid-spring all the way until the fall, working. So music is a very important one for me, sort of getting situated. And then at 10 a.m. on the nose, I have one regular Coke over ice.
Really?
It's my one really bad habit, and something that I should really, as my students like to say, that's going to kill you. And I acknowledge that that's probably true, but I've never been able to shake it as a habit. But I have one. It reminds me of my father, who likes a Coke, and it reminds me of him, and it gets me ready to get it. Sort of after a few hours writing, it perks me back up.
Good for you. That's interesting. What is something we would be surprised to learn about you, besides that you're 6'6" and you lived in China and you drink one iced Coke a day? What is something?
So what? That's an interesting one. So
something leapt to mind.
Right. Well, I'm trying to think if there's something better. I worked on Scarlett Johansson's very first professional show, and I didn't know it. I saw her first film, which was Lost in Translation. I think that was her first film, but I saw Lost in Translation. It was the first time I ever saw Scarlett Johansson. And I'd lived in China, and Lost in Translation was set in Japan, and it
right.
really struck me. And I just remember it really impacting me, and I really identified strongly.
It was
interesting.
Bill Murray was in that?
And I remember identifying both with the middle-aged white man, although I wasn't a middle-aged white man at the time, and identifying strongly with the young woman, even though I wasn't a young woman then. It was a movie that really hit me. So I was like, who is this girl? I think she's wonderful. So I went to IMDb and I looked her up, and I scrolled down through her credits, and at the bottom of it is a play from 1993 called Sophistry, which is a play that I worked on when I was interning at Playwrights Horizons. It was my first job out of college, and it was an interesting play. It starred Ethan Hawke and an actor named Steve Zahn, who has been in a ton of movies. And then it also featured Anthony Rapp, who was the lead in the Broadway production of Rent. So it had this unbelievable cast, And I'm reading down the list of credits, and there's Scarlett Johansson. And it occurred to me that at the end of Act One of this play, a little girl, about a 6 or 7 year old girl, had like a walk on part. She had about a 2 minute scene at the very end of the play. It was the only time she was in the play. She was never at rehearsals. She wasn't involved with any of that. She was only really there for dress rehearsals and the run of the show, and her mother would bring her, she'd do her piece, and then she'd go home. She wasn't there for the curtain call. She'd go home and go to bed. And that was Scarlett Johansson.
Matt,
so
it's a thin thread, but I'm giving it to you because it's the end of the hour, okay?
Oh,
so,
okay. Sure.
I thought you were going to tell me something about you that we'd be really stunned, but that's okay. So here's my last question to you. Scarlett Johansson and I are going to write a book about your life. What are we going to call it? What are we going to title it?
I would say Second Chances.
There you go. Matthew Fitzsimmons, the stunning novel is called The Short Drop. I am certain that you are on lists for awards. If not, you should be. And absolutely fabulous reviews in Amazon, 4,300 of them. I can't thank you enough for coming on. When your next book comes out, will you come back?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you for helping to teach me how to do radio interviews. Between you and Jennifer, these are my first two, so I'm still learning. I thank you for being patient with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You'll come back and take a turn behind the mic, and I'll be your production assistant, and you can interview whoever you want. How's that?
That sounds fantastic.
Anybody in particular you'd like to interview?
I think I'd like to interview Reed Farrell Coleman.
I can do that. He's a great guy. Yeah, he's a lot of fun, and we'll set that up. And you'll come back and be the host, and I'll get Reed to come on. He's a terrific guy. And maybe even when we're at VoucherCon this year, we'll do that. How's that?
Sounds like a deal.
Matthew Fitzsimmons' debut novel is called The Short Drop. You got to go and get it. It is terrific. Tomorrow, for all of you who are visiting with me tomorrow night, I am speaking to the lovely Ann Voss Peterson. On Wednesday, Mike Sears. And then I'm off to Sleuthfest on Florida's East Coast. But we'll come back, and we're going to do Dames in the Dark on Monday for Noir on the Radio. Matthew, thank you for being with me. I have just enjoyed this time so much. Have a great evening.
Thank you so much.
I look forward to talking to you again soon.
You bet. Thanks so much, Pam.
You're absolutely welcome. Good night. And good night, my friends. Have a really good evening. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.